Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Let's play. I'm the kind of girl, a little mystique, and you're the only one I've ever met who can't handle it. You climb my wall, break down my door. I think you might be just the kind of boy I've been waiting for. Hey, hey, people say you're wild and unpredictable. I don't care why you know I like you anyway. Your moves are very cool, but I can't be just as impossible. So if that's how you wanna play, let's play. I'm ready for some fun, and maybe you're the one. I wanna get you out on the floor and dance until my feet are numb. And when you get close, it's like rubber in my bones. And by the look in your eyes, you're melting down into the danger zone. Hey, hey, people say you're wild and unpredictable. I don't care why you know I like you anyway. Your moves are very cool, but I can't be just as impossible. So if that's how you wanna play, let's play.
Hi, welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show tonight. And our guest is going to be up in just a moment. His name is Sean Carroll, and he is a physicist, a theoretical physicist. And we also just heard a very, very special song, and she's 13 years old, and it's called Let's Play Radio. Her name is Amelia Bloom. She lives in Australia. She was on our show, and I like that song really well. So, Amelia, if you're listening, we love you. We love your song. And I'm going to bring up my co-host before we introduce our guest tonight, Miss Love.
Yes. Hi, Joy. How are you today?
I'm doing well, and how are you?
I'm wonderful and excited once again to be co-hosting with you. Thank you very much, and hello to all of our listeners out there.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to tell people that you had been involved with TV, and you've done quite a bit of very impressive interviews yourself, including LaToya Jackson, Steven Seagal,
yes,
and Harry Belafonte, but those are just a few. Wow.
Yes, and it was all have been wonderful experiences to be able to talk to and interview people of their great standard and stature. So very exciting for me, again, to be here, and we have a
Thank
wonderful
you.
Guest.
Mm-hmm. We're happy to have you. And I'm going to tell you, Ms. Love, that as mentioned, Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech in California, sunny California, and his research interests include theoretical aspects of cosmology, field theory, and gravitation. And I was thinking that, you know, his book, I want to be sure and talk to him about his book, and I know you had a couple of things you wanted to bring up about Sean.
Right. I understand he just finished writing a very popular level book on cosmology and the arrow of time called From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. Now, that is a very interesting concept to me because I'm very fascinated with time. And beyond just being conscious of time management in one's
sure.
day, day-to-day activities, it's very important to have a concept of time and in terms of being accomplishing things in a day. So I'm very curious as to his take on this. So this should be quite interesting.
Well, you know, Ms. Love, he previously wrote a graduate physics textbook called Space, Time, and Geometry, An Introduction to General Relativity. And Sean also recorded a set of lectures on cosmology for the teaching company.
Wow. That's very interesting. He seems to be quite the brainiac.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sean wants to learn more about fundamental physics by studying the structure and evolution of the universe. That's a big subject. And he is especially interested in inflation, the era of time, and what happened on or before the Big Bang. So those are just a few of things that we will bring up tonight.
Very interesting, the Big Bang theory. Now, I haven't heard anyone touch on that in a while. That should be quite interesting as well. And I understand that he's also done a bunch of work on dark matter and dark energy, modified gravity and topological defects, extra dimensions and violations of fundamental symmetries. Now, I know all of this might sound a bit deep or over the heads of some of us, you know, out here listening, and hopefully Sean will be able to put a lot of this in layman's terms for us so we can grasp a pretty good understanding of, you know, what his studies are involved in.
Yes, and I'm sure he will. I actually heard him on Coast to Coast, a very live, a very popular radio show, and he spoke to in such a way that anyone could understand, basically physics. And I thought, my goodness, I've got to share him with our audience, because physics being brought to the average person's mind, and wow, that's really exciting. So that's exactly why I invited him tonight. And I'm going to go ahead and bring him up, and he will tell us for sure all of the things that we left out. And hello, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, and how are you tonight?
Great.
Well, welcome to the show. We're just honored to have you. We are really excited for you to share some of the things you've been doing and things that are coming up in your life. You know, Sean, just to let you know, we have a very broad general audience that will be listening tonight and also downloading the show. So it's up to you to make the average mind understand these very, very intense subjects. But I know you can, because I heard you do that.
That's fine. It should be no problem, yeah.
Great. Well, your book is amazing. I'm looking at the cover of it right now, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. Maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words.
Sure. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I live here in Los Angeles, and I work at Caltech, which is in Pasadena. I've been here for the last 3 or 4 years. So I'm a theoretical physicist, which means I basically sit in my office, or I go to Starbucks, and I have a pencil and paper, and I sit down and I think about theories, models for what the universe could be like, and I work out with equations what the different predictions of different theories might be, try to match them to the universe we see.
Oh, so you're actually sipping a latte while you're doing some of this big brain work.
That's right.
That definitely brings it to home. I think Ms. Love and I both had a latte now and then.
Yes. Now, what I thought was very interesting was you touched on general relativity, and I understand this is a theory of gravitation that was developed by Albert Einstein back in the early 1900s. Now, what interest made you interested in this? Was it Albert Einstein's works that you were following, or did you read a lot of his books and discoveries and made you interested in studying further for yourself?
Yeah, I was one of those lucky kids who hit very, very early on what I wanted to do for my whole life. So I was something like 10 years old, fourth grade probably, when I started reading these books about the Big Bang and black holes and particle physics, curved space-time, and I just thought it was all fascinating, and I didn't know what it meant to be a person who did that for a living, but I presume that they existed, and so I just tried to pursue that as far as I could. So Einstein, of course, is the greatest physicist of the 20th century, and he was the one who explained to us that space and time are both aspects of one underlying space-time, and it's the curvature of that space-time. Space-time has a geometry, and it can change and move from place to place, And that's what shows up as gravity. That's what shows up as why the Earth goes around the sun or why apples fall off of trees.
Hmm. Well, you know, were your parents physicists or scientists, John?
No, not at all. There's no one in my family, as far as I can tell, who had any scientific background whatsoever. It just sort of struck me out of the blue when I was a kid, you know, in the Bucks County Public Library, and stuck with it ever since.
Amazing.
Very interesting. Well, what do you think about the recent, you know, with the recent earthquakes over in Chile? And I guess they're saying now that the days are going to be shortened because of the shift of the Earth's mass. Is that something that you're familiar with?
A little bit, yeah. In fact, here in L.A., we just had an earthquake last night. At 4 a.m., we were awoken by a little bit of jiggling, but it was a very tiny one. Of course, the earthquake in Chile was much bigger than that, and also the one in Haiti. And it's true that what we call a day, the time it takes the Earth to rotate once around its axis, is not really a deep fundamental constant of nature. It's just something that has to do with the particular history of the Earth and how much mass it has and how it's evolved over the last 4.5 billion years. And the time that it takes the Earth to rotate changes. Usually it changes very gradually because the moon and the other things in the solar system are interacting with the Earth, but sometimes it changes relatively suddenly, like when there's an earthquake. And that's what happened just recently. The Earth sort of settled down a little bit. After that earthquake, it became a little bit smaller. And just as if you're a figure skater doing circles, spinning, and you have your arms spread out, you can increase the rate at which you're speeding by dragging your arms in close to you. You spin faster and faster. And that's just what the Earth did. The Earth became a little bit smaller because it settled down during the earthquake, and so it spins a little bit faster than it did a few weeks ago. And therefore, the day is just a little tiny fraction of a second shorter than it used to be. Nothing you'd ever notice, but it's definitely there.
Wow, that is so interesting. I have to say I'm very fascinated by time and dimensional things, but what is your definition of time, or the arrow of time, and maybe in layman's terms so that we can all understand?
Yeah, I think that's what my whole book is about. And there's one of the issues that we have to sort of come to grips with is the fact that there are two different ways in which we use the word time. One is that it's just a label on the universe. It's something to help us find things. So you say that we're going to meet someone for coffee at our Starbucks at 5 p.m., okay? That just helps you and your friend know exactly what event in the whole universe is supposed to be the place where you're going to rendezvous. But then, and that's actually fairly well understood. That's something that we have a pretty good grasp on. The other thing going on is the arrow of time. The fact that the past is different from the future. And that's a little bit more mysterious. There's no arrow of space, for example. If you want to meet your friend for coffee, you need to tell them when to meet, but also where to meet. But if you're out there, if you were in between the planets in a spacesuit just floating around, there'd be no difference between up, down, left, right, forward, backward. Whereas there's a definite difference between yesterday and tomorrow. That's very, very clear. So there's this directionality aspect, pointing from the past to the future, that's the arrow of time that makes it a little bit different from space, and that's one of the mysteries we need to confront.
Absolutely. You know, go ahead, Miss Love.
No, please, Joy. I know we both have plenty of questions to ask. I think I've been hogging up. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely fine. I was just going to ask you about... you know, the whole story, what does the whole story have to do with the universe as a whole and the Big Bang?
Well, that's a very good question. We actually understand how time works and how the arrow of time works on a day-to-day basis. It all comes back to entropy, how organized the universe is. When the universe is highly, highly organized, like an unbroken egg, we say that it has low entropy. It's very, very delicately arranged. And then if something is like a scrambled egg, that is very disorganized, we say it has high entropy. And entropy tends to go up. You can take an egg, you can scramble it. That's easy enough.
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult to unscramble an egg.
Yeah.
Or if you have a stack of papers on your desk, it's easy enough to sort of knock them around and scatter them around your desk, but they're never going to spontaneously unscatter and hop up to be a nice organized pile of papers on the desk. And so that's really what picks out the arrow of time, the fact that the universe becomes more disorganized, becomes messier and more chaotic as time goes on. And it's easy to understand because there's just more ways to be messy and chaotic than there are to be nice and neat and orderly. There's more ways for the egg to be scrambled than for it to be a nice unscrambled egg like would come out of a chicken. But the problem is, so why was the universe so organized to begin with? The reason why entropy can increase, the reason why the universe can become more chaotic is because it used to be very orderly. It used to be highly, highly organized. And we can trace that all the way back to the initial conditions, to the very start of the universe. 13.7 billion years ago, at the Big Bang, the universe was very, very delicately arranged in a particular configuration. And that has been sort of decaying. The universe is becoming more and more chaotic and messy ever since. That's reflected in the fact that we have an arrow of time around us every day.
Getting an egg to unscramble. Can you imagine? Will we be able to do that at some point?
Well, you know, you could do it if you had sufficiently good patience and very, very fine tweezers. You can make things organized, but it's just much easier to make them disorganized.
I see.
Well, it, maybe it's easier, but isn't it better? Is it for our benefit to, of course, have things more organized?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, we think of ourselves as fairly organized. You know, our bodies are these exquisitely functioning mechanisms where we have the central nervous system and the blood and the muscles and the skeleton and everything, and it all works together very easily, just like, you know, a machine or something like that that we would build and organize. And so you might very well ask, how could very organized things like we see all around us arise out of this purported increase of chaos throughout the history of the universe?
Mm-hmm.
And there, people have thought about this, and there is, in fact, an answer. It's true that we're pretty organized, you and I, but the reason we're here is just a reflection of the universe as a whole trying to get messier and messier. It turns out that even though we're organized, our existence contributes to the disorganization of the universe around us. You might know about some people who you can certainly say make things more disorganized just by entering the room.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that at a quantitative level, if you run through the equations, we all do that at some deep level.
That is very interesting, and especially in relation to just everyday life. And like you said, someone can enter the room and immediately things are disorganized just, you know, based on their energy and mass.
That's funny.
You touched on the Big Bang theory a little bit, and what is... I mean, the whole story has to do with the universe as a whole and the Big Bang. And maybe you touched on that in your previous statement, but just kind of to put that back into perspective. And then even you can even explain to our audience what the Big Bang, and some of us know, but just, you know, what do we consider the Big Bang?
Sure. It was a great discovery back in the 1920s by Edwin Hubble that the universe is made of galaxies, and the galaxies are all moving away from each other. So we had known for a long time that we live in a galaxy. A galaxy is just a collection of stars that orbit all around each other. We live in the Milky Way, and that's a galaxy with about 100 billion stars. But what Hubble realized was that these little smudges that you could see in your telescope were actually separate galaxies all by themselves. And so we now think that there's about 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. And they each have 100 billion stars each. Some of those stars are going to have planets. It's a very big universe out there. But not only that, it's getting bigger. You know, the galaxies are all moving away. It was, again, Edwin Hubble showed that distant galaxies are moving away faster the further they are away. So really, it's just a reflection of the fact that every galaxy is moving away from every other galaxy, which Einstein gives us an explanation for. He says that space itself is expanding. The amount of space in between the galaxies is growing. But that means that you can sort of rewind. If the universe is expanding, if everything is getting further apart, then in the past, everything was closer together. And there's a point where if you go back into the past far enough, everything was just on top of everything else. And that's the Big Bang. About 13.7 billion years ago, the universe was hot and dense and smooth, and everything was piled on top of everything else.
I'm sorry. So I just wanted to ask
one
more question.
Sure.
Do you feel that there's any relation to the whole thing about based around 2012 and the Big Bang? Is that like another Big Bang theory that people are expecting to happen again? Basically the same theory.
No, I wouldn't worry about 2012. There was some interesting speculations because the Mayan calendar works on cycles. The ancient Mayans, the people who were a civilization in Central America, built this elaborate calendar system, which is fascinating. And it goes on cycles, and it turns over, and the cycles are very, very long. And one of those cycles is coming to an end in 2012. But that's okay. That's just like, it's not the end of the world. It's more like, you know, December 31st. It's more like the end of a certain calendar, okay? You just go to the next year, and it's not really a big deal.
Not a big deal. Well, can we look forward to having a home on Mars and Venus and Uranus? I mean, will this be everyday, you know, like a commonplace thing to have our retirement home on another planet?
I'm not sure. I mean, that would be very interesting. I think that's a sort of, not a super long-term question, but a medium-term question. People tend to underestimate how really, really difficult it is just to get to space. We can do it. You know, we send astronauts to space all the time. But getting to the moon is very difficult. Getting back is very difficult. Getting to Mars or to another planet like that would be enormously more difficult than that. And then getting back would be extremely difficult as well. Even if we could, for example, send people to Mars, it would be extremely difficult to return them safely. Not that we couldn't do it, but just that it's not something we're going to be doing in the next 5 years. It's going to take decades of planning and effort before we're able to do something like that. But I think we should. You know, it's definitely one of the long-term goals for the human race is to spread out, if only for our own safety, right? If we live on different planets, then the human race is a lot safer than if we are only right here and are sort of tied to what happens here on Earth.
Absolutely. Because I thought that by now we would have been on other planets, but I guess I kind of was ahead of the time with that. But I would think that with all the other places, other stars and planets in the universe, that we wouldn't be so concerned about global warming and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it kind of makes Earth seem so small to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that it's very difficult to predict the rate at which technology moves forward. It's sort of easy to imagine certain technological advances, but it's very hard to say when they're going to get here. You know, we'd like to extend our lives so we live a lot longer. We'd like to be able to go to the moon and to the other planets. There's a lot of things we'd like to be able to do. I personally would like a jetpack. I would rather not have my car. I'd like to be able to fly to work every morning. But it's hard. You know, jetpacks were talked about decades ago, and yet we don't have any. You know, going to the moon and going to the other planets was talked about a long time ago. On the other hand, nobody predicted cell phones or the internet or laptop computers. So we sort of get some things faster than you predicted. We get some things slower than you predicted. And it's just hard to know what's going to get here at what time.
At what time? The timing, If there is a parallel universe, I mean, there are a lot of parallel universes, I would think, going on. And so right now there are other us's in another dimension. Is that right? I had Dr. Michio Kaku on my show, and that was his theory, that we are going on in another dimension.
Well, we're definitely talking about theories here, not quite yet realities that we've demonstrated in any way. So we have the universe we see. Like I said before, the universe we see is already pretty big, 100 billion stars per galaxy and 100 billion galaxies. But we don't see the end of it. You know, there's only a certain amount of the universe that we can see in our telescopes. It might go on much, much farther than that. And so there might very well be multiple things that have different conditions that we would call multiple universes, places where things are very different, places where things are relatively similar. There could be an infinite number of these things. Right now, that's really just speculation. It might be useful speculation. It might help us explain certain features of the world we do live in, but we're certainly not allowed to say that we know that these things exist.
You're not allowed. Well, yeah, I understand that. I would like to take just a short break if it's all right with you, Sean.
Sure.
And we'll listen to a little music. It's a cello piece by Rebecca Rodman. She's been a guest on the show, and she is in two Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, where I am, San Francisco Symphonies. And again, her name is Rebecca Rodman. Rebecca Rodman, can she play a cello or not? She's quite the celloist. Rebecca Rodman, thank you. Welcome back, Sean. We have as our guest Sean Carroll. He is the author of From Eternity to Here. He is a physicist at Caltech, and we are really honored to have him. I want to let everyone know that we do have a call-in number if you have any questions to ask Mr. Carroll. Sean, is it Dr. Carroll?
It is, but Sean is fine.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And the number is 347-326-9915. And we are also honored to have Miss Love. Hello, Miss Love. Are you there?
Hello. Of course I'm here.
Hi.
Can't go anywhere. Sean is very fascinating.
Yeah. We could keep him all night. I have so many families out there that want to know, how can I get my child into science and how can I get them really interested? And, Sean, I'm not sure. Museums, what would you suggest to the parents out there that have little kiddos? They want them to learn physics. They want them to learn how to be astronaut. What would you say?
Yeah, I don't think there's any right or wrong way. I think that there's a lot of different things that get kids interested in science. In fact, on my blog, Cosmic Variants, we just did a poll. We asked people who had actually become scientists or gotten some degree from college in a scientific area, what was it that first got them interested? And the answer is that there was no one thing that was bigger than everything else. Sometimes it was books. Sometimes it was museums, sometimes it was teachers, sometimes it was role models, sometimes it was fiction, it was science fiction or fantasy or movies or TV or some activity, some science fair or something like that. So I think that different people have their imagination sparked in different ways.
Yes, absolutely. And I know we have a caller would like to ask you a question. Is it all right if I bring this caller up?
Sure.
Hello, 510.
Hello, how are you doing, Joy?
Hi, is this John?
Yes, it is.
Hi, John. This is a friend I have met that has written a book himself, science fiction. And is that the Freddie Anderson Chronicles, right?
That's correct.
great. And I know that you have just gotten that published, and it's going to be out on the market. When is that, John?
Oh, it should be out of the market early April.
April. So I would think that science fiction writers would have a lot of questions for a physicist. And if you want to ask your question?
Yes, I did. Sean, it sounded like you were saying that space is an actual substance. Is that correct?
Well, I guess the only straight answer is it depends on what you mean by a substance. I mean, space and time are both ingredients in the way that we describe the world around us, that's for sure.
Okay, well, if space is a substance and there is more space between the galaxies, where's the space coming from?
It's just being created. There's no rule that says that the amount of space is constant. Space grows as the universe expands.
Ah, okay. And how does that happen?
Well, this is all an upshot of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Einstein says that space and time don't just sit there. They evolve and they grow and they change and they can be curved in different places. And, you know, furthermore, it's been observed. We've seen the effects of this. We see not only that the galaxies are moving apart from us, but we see that in the early universe, everything was much hotter, much denser, and expanding at a rate that is predicted very, very precisely by Einstein's theories. So
mm-hmm.
Einstein says these things that sound like crazy speculations about space and time expanding, but then we use them to make predictions, and those predictions come true.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Well, thanks for calling in, John. We look forward to reading your book, Freddie Anderson Chronicles, and we will be having John on our show. Talking about his book, I'm really excited. So thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell everyone out there that your website is www.preposterousuniverse.com. And for everyone, if you want to know how to spell it and all that, you can just go to the show page tonight, and it's right there. But if you want me to spell it out, I'll get Sean to do that. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, it's preposterous. It's just like the word is spelled, P-R-E-P-O-S-T-E-R-O-U-S, universe, U-N-I-V-E-R-S-E, preposterousuniverse.com.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful website. Well done. It's
Thank you.
To navigate. Yeah. So some of them, you know, are not quite that easy, but yours was just great. And what's your next book?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Most of what we do as scientists is, you know, the research that we do is not actually published in books. It's published in papers that appear in journals, articles. So right now I'm getting back to writing papers, trying to think about different theories for what happened in the early universe and dark matter and dark energy and all that fun stuff.
Okay.
Oh, and speaking of that, because that was my next question, for you to please explain to us what dark matter and dark energy means. What does that mean?
Sure. These are just things that exist in the universe, in fact, constitute most of the stuff in the universe. But which we can't directly see. So that sounds like we're fudging, like somehow we're making things up. But even though you can't see things, you know they're there. For instance, you know the air is in the room in front of you. And how do you know? Well, you can feel it. If you just wave your hand back and forth, you feel the air pushing against your hand. So even though it's invisible, it's obviously there. Likewise, in the universe, we can detect things without seeing them because we feel or we detect the forces, the gravitational pull that they exert on other things. Dark matter is just some kind of matter, some kind of particle that moves around in the universe. Light passes right through it, so we can't see it directly, but it still has gravity, even though it's dark. So we can feel the gravitational pull of this kind of matter, and we call it dark matter. We can measure very precisely how much there is of it. The dark energy is more mysterious. It exists because instead of pulling the universe together, the dark energy actually pushes the universe apart. And this was a big discovery in 1998. Everyone presumed that the universe was slowing down in its expansion because all the galaxies pull on each other. But what they discovered in 1998 was the universe is actually accelerating. It's expanding faster and faster. So that turns out to be the very natural consequence of this stuff called dark energy that was invented by Einstein back in 1917. And together, it all fits into a very nice story. We have 4% of the universe is ordinary stuff, like you and me and stars and planets and gas and dust. 23% is dark matter, leaving 73% of the universe is dark energy. And that recipe fits a tremendous amount of data from astrophysics and from all over the place. So we're pretty sure that something like that is true, even if we don't know exactly the identity of these mysterious stuff yet.
Quite interesting.
Yeah. You know, the thing about physics are to me is that there are so many questions that we don't even know, you know, to ask because we're not that familiar, but I have been kind of following Dr. Stephen Hawking, and he wrote, was it Somewhere in Time?
A Brief History of Time.
A Brief History of Time. And I know that you met him, and he's quite brilliant. And would you say that he has almost taken over Einstein's spot? Or, well, I know he has Dr. Isaac Newton's chair at Cambridge University.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Well, he did. He resigned very, very recently.
Oh.
So he used to have Newton's chair at Cambridge.
Oh.
But, you know, it's a little bit unfair to compare anyone to Einstein because there's very few Einsteins out there. I think that in some sense, Stephen Hawking was Einstein's successor. He, you know, Einstein taught us more than anyone else about how gravity works in the first half of the 20th century, and Stephen Hawking taught us more than anyone else about how gravity works in the second half of the 20th century. So given the fact that he operates under severe physical handicaps and so forth, it's just an amazing story that he's been able to contribute what he has.
Yeah, because I was reading when you met him and picked him up at, was it in Santa Barbara and traveling with him. And he has Lou Gehrig's disease, and he cannot do anything really, can he? He's totally confined to a wheelchair, yet he's done amazing things, you know, and I have watched him closely over the years, just absolutely amazed at what he has done with nothing. You know, his body is just non-existent, but his mind is just getting bigger and bigger, kind of like.
That's right. No, it's really quite amazing how well he's been able to do, and he's able to move his wheelchair, and he's able to talk through a voice synthesizer, but that's about it, which is kind of impressive.
That is. That's impressive. Well, I'm not going to ask you to stay, you know, long, but I would like to have you share with people out there, Sean, what is it that, you know, the average person that really physics sounds like something they cannot obtain to, they cannot reach. Are there some books out there or people maybe that you would suggest that the person listening out there that wants to know more that can bring physics to their level, what would you suggest?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, the thing about physics is it seems very intimidating, but it's our universe. We all live in the universe, and I think it's available to everyone. Let me just be slightly nepotistic and suggest my wife's book. My wife, Jennifer Willett, is a science writer. She's not a scientist. She's an English major and, you know, fell in love with science late in life and has written a couple of books and has another one coming out that are all about explaining science to people who have no scientific background whatsoever.
Oh, wonderful. What is her name again, Sean?
It's Willett, O-U-E-L-L-E-T-T-E.
And we can find her books on your website. Is that right?
You can find a link to her website, yes, or you can just go to Amazon.com. She wrote a book called Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, which are a whole bunch of stories about the history of physics.
Wonderful.
So she likes telling stories.
Sure.
And the other one is The Physics of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Physics of the Buffyverse.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. How interesting is that? Wow. I'm so glad you brought that up because that was something I was not aware of. And many people out there would love to know about. So I want to, and her name again?
Jennifer Willett.
Oh, great. Wow. I'm going to check out her books, and I hope everyone else will. And I want to, Ms. Love, did you have some more questions?
Yeah, well, I think that's very nice and special that you would suggest your wife's book. And I feel like you're definitely a good judge of character. And for you to, beyond her being your wife, I think I'm just excited again to have a piece of material to reference. And I had actually kind of a strange take on time. And I'm wondering if you also touch on there being different or extra dimensions at the same time. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't talk about that much in this book,
mm-hmm.
but I have thought about it. I mean, I write papers about it. And excuse me, the idea of extra dimensions is something that physicists take very seriously, but again, it's hypothetical. It's speculative right now. So we don't exactly know how it would work, how we would notice, but we're actually trying to do experiments that would tell us whether or not extra dimensions exist. So I would just say hang in there, and we're trying to learn more about that.
Right. Well, I'll just say really quickly also, the reason why I think like of that is, you know, in relation to like deja vu or when people feel like they've been someplace before, or I'll even something that happened to me at one time. I remember waking up. I went through a series of just simple events, waking up, alarm clock goes off, I woke up. One of my family members yelled something to me. I responded, and a door shut. And that, you know, that was that. It was like a morning routine, like basic 5-10 minutes. And then immediately after, it seemed to me that it happened again. And so I'm just wondering if that would be something related to extra dimensions, or, you know, like a, in terms of time or space. It was just very. It was something very real that you know, I experienced. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't on any drug or anything like that. It happened in a natural state, so that's why I touched on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are very mysterious things, and I think that the place where the mystery is liable to be understood is more likely in understanding how the brain works and how our psychology works. I think, you know, the laws of physics don't have a lot to say about that, but we have a lot to learn about the brain before we can claim to understand it. So, again, that's another place where we should tune in. We're just beginning to learn about that.
We're just starting. And, Sean, Carol, I want to let you know that you are welcome to be on our show anytime. Bring your wife, and we would love to have you. And we're actually just about to go national, and so we'd love for you to be our first guest. I am absolutely enthralled and excited to present scientists, brilliant scientists to everyone, because basically we wouldn't be here without you, Sean. We would not be here. I think we forget that.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Miss Love. You are wonderful.
Thank you both. Thank you.
And I'm going to end the show tonight with the Judy Joy Jones Show theme. It was written by a classical composer. He lives in Belgium. His name is Stefan Maillars. And again, our guests, our very special guest tonight was Sean Carroll, Dr. Sean Carroll. And his book, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. And you can find more about Sean on our show page. You can find a lot about Sean there, actually, along with his website and his blogs, his science blog website. And so we're going to go ahead and, again, thank you, Sean, and thank you, Ms. Love.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan Maillard, classical composer from Belgium. And that was just a little bit, not the whole piece, of the Judy Joy Jones Show theme. Thank you so much, Miss Love. You were wonderful, and I really appreciate you being here with us. And Dr. Sean Carroll, who is a theoretical physicist at Caltech in California, and his book is called From Eternity to Here. Good night, everyone. We love you, and thank you, Alan Levy, for Blog Talk Radio.